This is Irene Friedman, and the program is all about animals. Coming up today, we'll be starting off with some jokes, and then I will continue in our fairly new book, started it a couple weeks ago, Tell Me Where It Hurts, by veterinarian Nick Trout. Then I have an article on diabetes in cats from Catster Magazine, and we'll see how far we get, and I have more to read if we have time. So let's get started with our jokes. Okay, joke number one goes like this. As soon as I find my place again. Okay, a wealthy businessman takes a trip to Asia and brings along his pet beagle. One day, the beagle decides to explore this new land and eventually finds himself lost. Wandering about, he notices a tiger heading quickly in his direction with intent of having the beagle as a snack. Worried, the beagle thinks, oh no, what am I going to do? Just then, he notices some bones on the ground close by, and being as clever as he is, he immediately settles down to chew on the bones with his back to the approaching cat. Just as the tiger is about to pounce, the beagle says loudly, boy, that was one delicious tiger. I wonder if I can find another. Hearing this, the tiger stops himself and slinks away, terrified, into the trees. Whew, says the tiger, that was close. That beagle nearly had me. Meanwhile, a monkey who was watching the whole scene from a nearby tree figures he can put this knowledge to good use and trade it for protection from the tiger. So he scurries off to go inform him, but the beagle sees the monkey heading after the tiger with great speed and figures that something must be up. The monkey soon catches up with the tiger, spills the beans, and strikes a deal. The tiger is furious at being made a fool of and says, here, monkey, come along and see what I'm going to do to that conniving canine. Now the beagle sees the tiger coming with the monkey and thinks, what am I going to do now? But instead of running, the clever beagle sits down with his back to his attackers, pretending he hasn't seen them yet. Just when he gets close enough to hear, the beagle says, where's that darn monkey? I sent him off a while ago to bring me another tiger. Okay. Okay. One day, a busy butcher notices a dog in his shop and shoos it away. Later, he finds the dog has come back, and the butcher sees that the dog has a note in its mouth which reads, can I have 12 sausages and a leg of lamb, please? The butcher looks, and lo and behold, there's a $10 bill in the dog's mouth. So the butcher takes the money, puts the sausages and lamb in a bag, and places the bag in the dog's mouth. The butcher is very impressed, and since it's closing time, he decides to close up shop and see where the dog goes. The dog walks down the street and comes to a crosswalk and puts down the bag, jumps up and presses the crossing button. Then it waits patiently, bag in mouth, for the light to change. The dog walks across the road with the butcher following. The dog then comes to a bus stop and starts looking at the timetable. The butcher is in awe. The dog checks out the bus times and sits on one of the seats to wait. Along comes a bus. The dog walks to the front of the bus, looks at the number, goes back to its seat. Another bus comes. Again, the dog goes and looks at the number. It seems that it's the right bus and climbs on. The butcher, by now completely flabbergasted, follows the dog onto the bus. The bus travels through town and out to the suburbs. Eventually, the dog gets up, moves to the front of the bus, and, standing on its hind legs, rings the bell to stop the bus. The dog gets off, the grocery still in its mouth, and the butcher continues to follow it. They walk down the road and the dog approaches a house and walks up the path and drops the groceries on the step. Then walks back down the path, takes a big turn, and throws itself whap against the door. It goes back down the path, takes another run, and throws itself whap against the door again. There's no answer at the door, so the dog goes back down the path, jumps up on a narrow wall, walks along the perimeter of the garden. It gets to a window and bangs its head against it several times. It walks back, jumps off the wall, and waits at the door. The butcher watches as a big guy opens the door and starts yelling at the dog. The butcher runs up and stops the guy. What are you doing? This dog is a genius. It could be on TV for Pete's sake. Genius my eye, the man says. This is the second time this week he's forgotten his key. Okay. And I think we'll stop there and get maybe an early start on Tell Me Where It Hurts, and maybe we'll have the benefit of Mark and his always present wit and humor next week. Okay, where we left off last week, the veterinarian is talking how he was examining an attractive woman's dog, and all of a sudden his face turns red and his skin starts getting puffy, and he's having this very strange reaction. And it turns out that he realizes that he has a sesame seed allergy, and this happened during the exam. He had eaten an energy bar with sesame seeds, and he was very, very embarrassed because it probably looked like Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, where he turns into this monster. Okay, so that's where we're going to pick up. The client was Miss Wright and her dog was Bailey. Returning to the story, when I found the examination room empty, I decided I must contact Miss Wright to apologize and explain. She took my call at work. Your head looked like it was about to explode. You look disgusting. I thanked her for her empathy. The thing is, I said fervently, I discovered that I am highly allergic to sesame seeds. What happened this afternoon might actually help save my life in the future. Rewarded with a weary, I changed tack. I never got to discuss the treatment options for Bailey, I said. Unfortunately, there's no way to repair the individual ligaments. Even if we could stitch them back together, they would heal with a scar, and scar tissue is just not strong enough to support his weight. We need to fuse the bones together. Poor old Bailey is going to require some orthopedic surgery. I see, she said too automatically, obviously not seeing at all. I tried to regain her confidence. Don't worry, I said, it won't be me performing the surgery. Thank God for that, she said, her relief unabashed, before adding, it's nothing personal, as an afterthought, just to make sure that I knew that it was. When Miss Wright returned some days later to drop off Bailey for a surgery, I made a point of admitting the dog. Surgery is scheduled for 2, I told her. Fine, she said, her tone still a tad clipped. As she made to leave, she hesitated, turned and asked, what are you having for lunch? I smiled and wanted to say a big bowl of sesame chicken with tahini and hummus. Instead, I risk. Not sure. Maybe a Big Mac. From the waiting room, I watched her go, crossing the parking lot, fumbling for her car keys, before the shocked expression on her face told me that she had just remembered what capped the famous double hamburger, the sesame seed bun. Trusting your pet to a new graduate for worming tablets, vaccines, and antibiotics is one thing, but trusting a new graduate with a scalpel requires an even greater leap of faith. Surgical training in veterinary school is a bit like going to a shopping mall without money. You get to look, occasionally try a few on for size, but chances are you won't walk away with something to call your own. After graduation, I remember feeling parched and restless for an authentic clinical experience in which I was the one who made a difference. Surgery had been the ultimate spectator sport, and after all the years in training and waiting on the sidelines, I was eager to play on its sterile fields. It appeared to hold the possibility of instant gratification from an act of manual intervention, a clean separation of before and after, of then and now, of disease and cure, and the unique distinction of letting me experience responsibility for that change. Perhaps this is why, when I considered the first time I helped engineer something approaching a life-altering change in an animal, my mind's eye falls upon a surgery involving a clumber spaniel called Norman. I see an image of Norman standing in the examination room. He was a handsome, burly young man, white fur with orange freckles, a huge head, and a square rosy nose with thick leathery triangles for ears. He was 4 years old in the prime of life, and despite his innate dignity and desire to please, he was utterly miserable. He did not want to move, not a single muscle, paralyzed by the fear of igniting the unendurable pain in his neck, bracing, frozen, and taut in permanent spasm. When I tried to move his head, even the smallest amount in any direction, he would let out a haunting scream. And any attempt to encourage Norman to move, let alone to walk, was met with rigid front legs locked in extension and a pleading expression in his big amber eyes that begged to be left alone. Norman had slipped a disc in his neck, a familiar insipid term that really doesn't do justice to the sometimes violent nature of the disease. Discs in between the bones of the spine as tiny shock absorbers with a tough exterior, encapsulating a soft pulpy center, a bit like a stale jelly donut. Problems occur when the dough splits and the jam squirts out. In Norman's case, the result was so painful and debilitating, we decided to recommend surgery. Of course, I'm using the professional we here, meaning that this was what the surgical resident told me to say to the owner. During that surgery, the resident had stood across the table from me the whole time. He approved every slice and snip. He held his breath as I worked my way through the depths of Norman's neck, hovering as I swept aside various and sundry tubes and pipes, little things like jugulars, carotid arteries, esophagus, and trachea. And fortunately, he did not have to make an emergency landing for me. Then, with saintly patience and a talent for hiding his fear, the resident stood back and watched as I began drilling a tiny window into Norman's spine. The process was slow and tedious, grinding bone into dust, fighting the certainty that I was about to wrap the dog's spinal cord around the end of my drill bit like soft linguine around a fork. And then, as the last sliver of bone dissolved away, I felt an absurd satisfaction as mealy white disc squeezed free of the spinal canal like toothpaste from a tube. By the following morning, Norman was ready for his reveal in an extreme canine makeover. And the new Clumber I saw was trotting around and showing no restriction in the movement of his head and neck. It was not the magic of the surgeon, it was the magic of surgery. It was not simply the dramatic nature of Norman's recovery, it was the struggle, the fear, the danger, and the perseverance that made it possible. You would think that after my sleepless night and the discovery of a new dog the next morning, I might remember my conversation with Norman's owners or the look on their faces when they came to the hospital to pick him up. But the memory banks are empty. And maybe that's the point, because in the end, there really is only one memory that matters, the face of a dog who could look up to make his shining amber eyes meet mine. One of my greatest flaws as a new graduate was the desire for sensationalism. I was always hunting for an obscure and possibly rare diagnosis, hearing the sound of hooves and thinking zebra and not horse like I was supposed to. I might have craved the unusual, fascinating, report-worthy cases, but a lot of what veterinarians do is straightforward and routine. When it is not at the early stage of our career, subtle flags of clinical significance may be overlooked, sometimes with dire consequences. This is to be expected. This is part of learning, of developing into a good clinician. It is an acquired skill. It is an acquired art, a skill that can develop only over time, and they call it clinical intuition, a sensation that triggers little alarm bells to ring inside your head when some small piece of a clinical puzzle does not seem to fit. I remember a particular case that tore into the parking lot while I was stranded among a poop archipelago in a sea of grass behind the hospital. The driver of the pickup truck screeched into a handicapped space, and from where I stood, politely averting my eyes as my patient squatted to pee for the umpteenth time, I noticed his rear bumper was peppered with bright stickers. Two in particular caught my attention. One read, "Gun control is making sure you don't miss your target," and the other wanted meaningful overnight relationship. Although I resolved not to be judgmental about the driver, my hackles were up when I found Mr. Measley, as we will call him, and his dog Thor, a 9-year-old boxer, waiting for me in an examination room. "Christ, Doc, I'm in a hurry here," said Mr. Measley, looking up at me from his slouch position on a bench. His face was tanned, unnaturally so for the time of year, and a tight black T-shirt hugged every ripple and bulge of his upper arms and chest. He winced at me, premature wrinkles crowding his eyes as though this visit were a painful experience. I ignored the hostility and offered my hand. I found his shake to be weak, warm, and a little sticky, his hand having recently glided through liberally gelled hair. The softness of his skin confirmed my assumption that this was a narcissistic snipe who frequented a tanning booth in the mirrored weight room of a local gym. So much for not being judgmental. His dog, on the other hand, came toward me with that wonderful, sloppy, and noisy enthusiasm that boxers have. I was introduced to Thor, a name that seemed so utterly inappropriate it came as no surprise. Thor snorted and smiled, his lower jaw protruding like a toothy shovel, all the while tugging on his leash, desperate to lap me up as his little propeller of a tail spun around and around. I could have explained that my appointments were not due to start for another 15 minutes, but thought better of it, inviting Mr. Measley to tell me what seemed to be the problem with Thor. "What do you mean, what's wrong?" he said, flashing me his best duh look. "Christ, what crap are they teaching you kids these days? I mean, really, just take a look at his tits." Up until this point, I had not noticed the fact that Thor did have profoundly pendulous breasts with dark pigmented nipples the size of my thumbs. I'm sorry, I said, I had assumed that he was a bitch. Do you think, said Mr. Measley, was the name Thor a giveaway? I wondered if I had the strength in my hands to throttle his thick muscle neck, but asked, so how old is Thor? He's 9. Had him since he was a pup. Thought it might help me get some babes, you know? Cute puppy out for a walk. Chicks love it. Did it work, I asked, noting that the fourth finger of his left hand was one of the few lacking a chunky piece of gold jewelry. Not really, he said with a trace of disappointment. Really, I said, with no trace of surprise. Yeah, now I'm trying one of those dating agencies, the ones that take a ton of money up front and then try to match you up with a perfect partner. All I know is that I'm still waiting to get laid. Really, I repeated, this time eager to move on. So, has Thor been neutered? Shit, no. I wouldn't let anyone do it to me, though there have been plenty of women who wish they could. He laughed and afforded me a smug grin. But then, old Thor only ever had one ball. One of them never grew, I guess. I thought I might breed him, but no one seemed interested in a boxer firing on only one cylinder. I nodded, scribbled, and said, so when did you notice his breasts enlarging? Mr. Measley took a sharp intake of breath. A couple of months ago, it's been gradual. He's been beefing up for a while, losing his tone. Not much of a six-pack left now, but then we don't go for as many walks on account of the other dogs. What do you mean? He hesitated as though this next revelation were difficult to confide. They've been trying to mount him, trying to hump him from behind. What worries me most is that he seems to like it. He just stands there and takes it. It's embarrassing. If you tell me my dog's turning gay, I'm going to have a shit fit. I tapped my fingers against my chin and roped in my response. And what about the hair loss on his flanks? How long has that been going on? I'm not sure, said Mr. Measley. I haven't really noticed. Secretly, I was beginning to get excited about Thor's case. Here at last was a dog that, unbeknownst to his master, had been sneaking around veterinary school libraries late at night. Has Thor been drinking more than usual? And suddenly I saw a spark in Mr. Measley's eyes. Every now and then there is a defining moment when a question that seems entirely out of left field to the owners but is rehearsed and natural to the vet comes across as astute and insightful as though hitting a clinical nail squarely on the head. This is probably the first time in my professional career that I had asked a question rewarded with a refreshing hint of respect. Come think of it, he has been drinking quite a lot, and pissing up a storm as well. What does that mean? I gave my best knowing nod, as though I were keeping him on tenterhooks as I got up to examine Thor, a certain swagger in my stride. Thor stood passively for his examination, unlike his master, who quipped sexual innuendos about how he wished he could get his hands on a camera, as I squatted squarely behind Thor, palpating his scrotum. What I found was that Thor's right testicle was nowhere to be found and that his left testicle was small and shrunken. He was balding over the sides of his body and his belly was a little distended. His temperature was slightly up and the energy he had first shown me seemed to ebb from his body until he flopped to the floor, apparently exhausted. And that's where we're going to stop, and we'll have to wait until next week to find out what has happened to Thor. And Mr. Measley, who sounds a little bit on the crude side. Okay, The Vet is In from Catster Magazine, written by Dr. Arnold Plotnick, who's the founder of Manhattan Cat Specialists, a feline-exclusive veterinary practice on Manhattan's Upper West Side. He's also an author of the original Cat Fancy Cat Bible, and Dr. Plotnick is a frequent contributor to feline publications and websites, including his own blog, Cat Man Do. He lives in New York City with his cats, Mittens, and Glitter. Diabetes in cats. As a feline practitioner, I often see the same client concerns repeatedly in our appointment schedule. Not eating, vomiting, diarrhea, losing weight, hair loss, urinating around the house, etc. I never know ahead of time what the diagnosis might be. However, when I see litter boxes flooded or huge urine clumps in litter box, one disease rises to the top of my list. Diabetes. Diabetes basics. Diabetes is the second most common glandular disorder in cats. Hypothyroidism is number one, if you were curious. Diabetes occurs as a result of a problem with insulin, the hormone that controls blood glucose levels. Similar to humans, cats experience two types of diabetes. In type 1 diabetes, the cat's pancreas simply can't make enough insulin. In type 2 diabetes, the pancreas can make insulin, but secretion of insulin is impaired. This is coupled with insulin resistance, an improper response by the body to the insulin that the cat is making. It is estimated that the majority, 80% of diabetic cats, are type 2 diabetics. This differs markedly from diabetes in dogs, all of which are type 1. The fact that the majority of diabetic cats retain the ability to secrete insulin has exciting implications for treatment. As you'll soon hear, it has been shown recently that tightly regulating the blood sugar with aggressive insulin therapy early in the course of treatment can cause many cats with diabetes to go into remission. Although diabetes can strike at any age, it typically strikes middle-aged cats, usually around 7 to 9 years of age. Males are 1.5 times as likely to be affected. Obesity is another risk factor. In Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, Burmese cats are at higher risk. In the United States, Maine Coon, Russian Blue, and Siamese are predisposed. The four classic signs of diabetes are increased thirst, excessive urination, ravenous appetite, and weight loss. Owners will often remark that their cat is losing weight despite eating very well. Owners also complain that they need to change the litter much more frequently and that the urine clumps have become enormous, the size of a cinder block, as one client once described it. A few owners report wobbliness in the cat's rear legs. This rear limb weakness is a condition called diabetic neuropathy. Affected cats exhibit a distinct posture called a plantigrade stance, where they walk or stand on their hocks instead of their toes. Diagnosis of diabetes is relatively straightforward. The presence of persistently elevated blood glucose in combination with excessive glucose in the urine is indicative of diabetes. Treatment options. The focus of treatment used to simply be the amelioration of the clinical signs. Over the last few years, this has changed. New, long-acting insulin preparations for humans have shown great efficacy in cats, in many cases resolving the diabetes completely. This diabetic remission has become the ideal goal, achieving normal blood glucose levels, ultimately without the need for insulin. Exactly which cats go into remission depends on the type of insulin, the cat's diet, how tightly the blood glucose is regulated, how early the treatment is initiated, the sooner the better, and whether the cat's pancreas is able to secrete insulin, as with type 2 diabetics. Diet is an important component of therapy. Newer studies have shown that the ideal diet for a diabetic cat is a high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet, with canned greatly preferred over dry. There are many prescription diets designed for this purpose, and nearly every veterinary office carries them. Some commercial brands, for example, some varieties of Fancy Feast, serendipitously, have a nutritional profile appropriate for diabetics. Ask your veterinarian for recommendations or conduct your own internet research. Insulin is the mainstay of therapy for diabetic cats. Both human and veterinary insulin preparations are available, and all of them work well. However, remission is more likely to be achieved with the newer, long-acting human insulin preparations, such as Glargine, that's G-L-A-R-G-I-N-E, brand name Lantus, and Detemer, brand name Levemer. Once insulin therapy has begun, blood glucose levels need to be frequently assessed to determine whether the dosage needs to be adjusted. Too little, and the disorder will not be controlled. Too much, however, can cause life-threatening hypoglycemia or low blood glucose. Clearly, close monitoring is paramount, and this used to require frequent veterinary visits that were inconvenient for cat owners and very stressful for the cat. Home monitoring of blood glucose using meters specifically calibrated for cats and dogs, for example, the AlphaTrack, has become an excellent additional tool to improve long-term management of diabetes. Blood is obtained from the marginal ear vein that runs along the outer edge of the ear, and blood glucose is measured with the meter during the day. Cats tolerate this very well. Your veterinarian, or more likely his veterinary technician, can demonstrate the technique in the veterinary office. Not every cat will achieve remission, and clients should be warned that some cats' remission may relapse at a later date. For those who don't achieve remission, the goals of therapy remain the same as always, resolving the clinical signs of excessive thirst, urination, and weight loss while avoiding complications such as hypoglycemia. Achievement of remission is a huge advantage, both the cat owner and the cat, and is an exciting new frontier for veterinarians. Okay, we have about a minute left, so a quick article from Modern Dog magazine, under the scoop column, there's a new dog on the block, the Ozawak, and that's spelled A-Z-A-W-A-K-H. The new dog on the block, the Ozawak, a member of the hound group, joins the pack as the latest AKC recognized breed. They have a side view of this dog, very elegant looking, kind of looks like a greyhound with this very, very narrow waistline and these long, elegant legs. So here's what they say. Get to know the latest breed recognized by the American Kennel Club, or AKC, the Ozawak. Pronounced Ozawak, this elegant beauty is an ancient breed that originated in West Africa. Although this leggy canine may look delicate, this breed was frequently put to use as a hunting sighthound. It was bred to be durable enough for hunting hare, antelope, and even wild boar. These athletic members of the hound group need their exercise, but they aren't all work and no play. Ozawaks are affectionate and keen to bond with their owners. They're cautious, however, and have a tendency to act aloof upon meeting strangers. In terms of exercise, these dogs make for calm indoor companions, but do require a lot of outdoor exercise and play outlets to satiate their need to run and hunt. With a short, fine coat, they only need occasional brushing. The Ozawak was officially recognized by the AKC on January 1st, 2019, so be sure to keep an eye out for this beautiful hound. It's also a beautiful golden red color with white on its chest and bottoms of its feet. Origin is West Africa, weight 33 to 55 pounds, energy levels high, speed is high, grooming needs low maintenance and affection. It is affectionate with bonded humans. So that's the scoop on the Ozawak. Maybe it'll be at the Westminster Cat Show. I think that's in February. Anyway, with that, I am completely out of time. So until next week, this is Irene Friedman. As always, spay and neuter your cats and dogs. Thank you for tuning and listening, and have a great day and a great week. Bye, everyone.